Okay, let's shall we okay, let's finish off the discussion of Harbison. What I want to emphasize here is again, the way in which these are issues of public policy, very sensitive public policy, for which there's no clear, decisive, make everybody happy answer. Any of the choices that you might make here in terms of public policy are going to rub some people the wrong way. And again, what you want to be on the lookout for in addressing a question like this is what, in my jurisdiction, has been the choice made with respect to these issues. I can tell you that the majority rule is to allow a recovery for wrongful birth in the case of children born with disabilities. Again, the public policy of providing the parents with compensation outweighs, for most jurisdictions, the queasiness about the process by which that compensation is awarded. By contrast, in the case of a child that's born healthy, the jurisdictions are about split, so that some, like Arizona, would allow a recovery on the same basis as the Arizona case. Other jurisdictions, like Washington as an example, would say in the case of a healthy child, we don't think there ought to be a recovery, or at least only for the nominal expense of childbirth, you know, lost income during pregnancy, and so forth, but nothing to compensate for the actual rearing of the child or anything like that. With respect to wrongful life, again, public policy is even more deeply divided. Some jurisdictions have said, in fact, no, we won't do this. Other jurisdictions like Washington say, yeah, we'll do it, but as you can see, there's not much here in terms of the wrongful life recovery. It's not very significant in monetary terms. So it's more, I would say, it's more questionable as an issue to push public policy in that direction. I can't help telling a story about teaching this class many years ago when I was going along doing the facts and a student said, well, there was reference to the fact that we have Elizabeth and then Christine, and a student raised his or her hand, I think it was a guy who said, well, I don't understand how they could recover for the second child after they'd had one child with this condition. And I said, well, you know, as a matter of fact, it's sometimes difficult, first of all, when a child is born, to make the diagnosis. As it happens, I have a child with Down syndrome, which is similar in many ways to the characteristics described for fetal Hydantoin syndrome, and while, you know, we knew from the time she was born, many children with Down syndrome go undiagnosed. Even if they were diagnosed with the condition, or, you know, it was obvious that something was wrong, the parents wouldn't necessarily have associated, nor would the pediatrician have necessarily associated it with the use of Dilantin, because after all, the physicians had already told her that these are the things that you could expect from Dilantin, and that wasn't what Elizabeth had. So I'm giving this explanation, and then I go back to having the student tell me more about the case, and the student starts off and saying, no, the parents didn't know. And I looked at him, and I looked at his name card. His name card said Michael Harbison. I had sort of picked on somebody because their last name was the same as the case. You would have thought, wouldn't you, that I'd be thinking this is over at the Air Force base on the other side of the state. The case is actually brought in Eastern. It's brought in the district for Eastern Washington here, isn't it? You think? Yeah. Filed in the United States District. No, it's actually in the Western District. Anyway, it's around here. And after all, the first child, you know. But I'm still not quite tracking, you know. I'm looking at this name card thinking, oh my God, what have I done? And, you know, as it happened, well, I this is one of your basic stupid questions. I'm looking at this and I say, you know the family? He said, yes, they're my sisters. And, of course, I just can't believe how stupid I was. You might believe it quite readily, but it always comes as quite a shock to me. But I immediately replayed in my mind, what things have I said in the last 20 minutes I would desperately like to have back? And as you've heard, I have an experience with my own child that would place me in a position most sympathetic. As I look back on what I had said, nothing that I had said would be particularly, nor was it. I talked to Michael afterward, and you know, tried to sort of find out if I had been insensitive, and he said, no, it's. And of course, he did a masterful job, just to describe the case. In a way that I didn't know until he made that statement that we were talking about his family. But one of the reasons I tell this little story is because, well, for several reasons. One, it's just sort of bizarre. Number two, it's an interesting thought experiment as we describe all these cases to sort of ask yourself the question, what would happen if the parties were here in the room. You know, if we were talking about somebody's sister or somebody's husband or somebody's child, you know, would it change our perspective on the way we talk about these things? And you'll notice I'm not terribly reverential toward the parties in the case. We regularly have fun at the party's expense here. You know, talking about Mr. McGrath and his trouble, you know, in the parking lot with his alternative methods of dispute resolution, you know. But it is true, of course, that for every one of these parties, they are somebody's, you know, that was, you know, somebody's baby, that was somebody's child. And anyway, something to think about. Now, I included the next case, Taylor versus Karapaty, mostly because it's, you know, obviously it's got all this, you know, case history of, gosh, it goes on and on and on, doesn't it? And on the one hand, I do apologize for sticking it all in there, but the main reason is because it offers a kind of counterweight to the analysis that's in Harbison versus Park Davis. You may agree with it, you may disagree with it, but again, I want you to see the way in which people feel quite passionately about these things. It is worth asking the question, I think, about not only what the court does, but what the court says about what it does. That functioning as a court, you have a responsibility not only to achieve what you think of as beneficial results, but you have a responsibility to sort of bear in mind, well, what does this say about the meaning of life to the extent that that we are taken to be saying something about the meaning of life. If we don't want to say something, we just want to achieve a result, maybe we should take into account, well, what are we saying about things that we think we're not saying, but in effect, by what we do, we are saying. In any event, as you can tell in Taylor versus Kuropaty, the narrow issue is whether the statute of limitations has run, and the court determines that it has. But in addition, there's this question about whether it ought to be a claim. And I must say, again, speaking from my own, you know, soapbox, that for my own editorial part, based on my own experience, I do think there is a troubling aspect that that to the extent the court in effect says children with disabilities have lesser value than children who are normal, I disagree. And to the extent that parents are asking for a judicial determination that they suffer damage, or worse yet, in effect, pushing their children forward and saying, here, you claim, or someone on your behalf should claim, that you would have been better off never to have been born, I'm sorry, I don't think that's appropriate. Nonetheless, that now I'll step off my soapbox long enough to say that the issue in the exam is to try to recognize the legal issues. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of figuring out whether you've got a claim that's a true wrongful birth, wrongful life claim, in which case you've got to go through all this stuff, or whether you simply have a claim in which a child is injured through somebody else's negligence and gets to recover the damages for having disability that they would otherwise not have had. Well, maybe I'll get back on my soapbox again here for a moment. You may have noticed as you've walked up and down the halls here, there's a plaque and a picture of one of our graduates, Holly Caudill, who was injured in a very serious rollover. She was in a van, I think, that rolled over when she was a teenager and was rendered a quadriplegic. The only way she could get around was she had one of these breath tubes so that she could blow into this thing and using a chin, sort of joystick kind of a thing, move her wheelchair around. And she got through college and she got through law school and was practicing with the U.S. Attorney's Office down in San Diego when the health conditions that, in addition to rendering her a quadriplegic, also wreaked havoc with all kinds of internal systems, and eventually she lost the battle at the age of, 26 or something like that. But she used to go around giving motivational speeches to teenagers, not about drinking and driving, which was sort of along the way. Yeah, oh, by the way, don't be stupid when you get behind the wheel of a car. But it was also essentially whatever your dreams are, don't let people tell you you can't achieve your dreams. Look at me. And she had a wonderful, marvelous attitude about life. And, she said, in effect, my life has its good days. My life has its bad days. I have things that make me happy. I have things that make me sad. I'm really not that much different from you. Now, the reason I bring that up is to say, if we are troubled by the notion of saying that, for example, a child with fetal hyde-antoin syndrome or a child with Down syndrome is of lesser value, has a less important life that somehow we should treat that as, oh, that's the end of the world. Well, does that also apply to people that are quadriplegics because of somebody's negligence? Now, you really wouldn't want the defendant to stand up if Holly Caudill filed a personal injury action, and I forget whether there was any litigation surrounding. I don't, as I recall, there wasn't. There wasn't anybody to blame, or at least nobody that had any money that she could blame for her injuries. But suppose there had been, it would have been a poor idea for the defendant to stand up and say, yes, but look at, you know, Holly Caudill someday will be a great motivational speaker and she'll go to law school and so forth. I mean, but again, it sort of makes you ask the question, how do we know what's good? How do we know what's bad? Do we do everybody a disservice by acting as though, well, normal life is sort of a bowl of cherries, it's all peaches and cream, and anything that isn't just like that is somehow aberrational? Now that I think of my own life, it's full of all sorts of, you know, ups and downs and twists and turns, and when I essentially say, well, the defendant caused this to happen, am I on the right track by sort of assuming, well, but for that, everything, you know, like Mrs. O'Shea, how do we know that she would have cooked till she was 75? When we're talking about Nancy Feldman, what would her career have been like? What would her life with Reed have been like if it weren't for this plane crash? Again, I don't want to be difficult, but I just sort of, while we're in this moment, ask ourselves the question, what is it we're about here when we make awards for non-economic damages, for pain and suffering, even for purposes of economic loss? Who's to say what's good or bad? But the law obviously does expect people to be compensated. Going back to Morris versus the railroad, we say, yeah, not being able to bowl, waking up in the morning with a stiff shoulder, having you know, limited use of your knee, these, if that's the result of the defendant's negligence, you get to recover for that in addition to whatever economic loss you've suffered. Okay, so again, back to the business at hand here, which is figuring out, how do I assess the damages that my client has suffered, or if I'm the defendant, how do I properly anticipate the kinds of damages that will be asserted, and which of those claims are appropriate, which of them belong, and which of them can I say, no, I'm sorry, the law draws a line and says you may not recover. We started with this middle section on wrongful death to say, well, in wrongful death cases, we have to displace, in effect, the recovery from the immediate victim to family members of the estate or what have you. In the wrongful birth, wrongful life claim, we say the birth of another human being may be the occasion of damage to the parents, maybe even to the child himself or herself. Now we shift on page 87 to look at claims of what I call bystanders. And Dillon versus Legg is the classic case in which you have an immediate victim, but you also have some people standing around who say, me too. I also deserve a recovery, and they're lining up at the cashier's window, and we have to figure out which of these claimants are entitled to a recovery. I know we're moving at a breakneck speed here, and I should have warned you that it would look like this, but here we are. Can somebody tell us about Dillon versus Legg? Well, maybe I'll get you started here and you can chime in here. Dillon versus Legg bears close study because, for one thing, it's often the reference point for discussions such as in the subsequent Washington cases that we look at. They go back to Dillon versus Legg as having sort of framed the issue. And a lot of the discussion that the court provides in Dillon versus Legg is used by other courts in setting the parameters for their own discussion. Okay, so we've got some kind of a street. Defendants driving down the street. There is a daughter. There's the mother, a daughter, and the sister. Daughter and sister are crossing the street. I can't remember whether there's a crosswalk or what. Why it is that the defendant is negligent. But apparently the defendant, either through excessive speed or not looking out or for whatever reason, the defendant negligently strikes and kills the daughter. Her sister nearby witnesses this, as well as the mother, who is on her front porch or otherwise at home, sees this occur and, of course, is traumatized. We have a wrongful death claim for the daughter. That's not really at issue here. In addition, we have the claim by the sister for being a bystander, and a claim by the mother for being a bystander. I'm sorry? But she's another daughter. I think that's... Yeah. I'm sorry. This is the relationship here. The sister of the decedent and the mother of the decedent. Okay. The relationships, of course, matter here. Now, the mother and the sister file claims for their injuries from being involved in this tragedy. And the defendant files a motion to dismiss the claim of the mother. And the trial court grants the motion, and the mother appeals. What's the rule of law that the court had applied? By what mechanism did the or by what reasoning or by what authority did the trial court reach the conclusion that the mother's claim was barred? Mr. Trujillo? Okay, the test that they had employed in the past, in fact, the case upon which this rule was based is a case called Amaya Ice or something like that. I can't remember the shorthand for the case. But in that case, they said, in effect, those parties who were in the zone of danger could recover. Now, this is sort of related to, obviously there are harmonic overtones here from Paul's graph, that the theory is that if the claimant is close enough to be put in physical peril, not necessarily impacted. They had an earlier rule. Amaya was an expansion of an earlier rule which said you had to have an impact. So before Amaya, the rule had been if the car had struck the sister, touched her in some way, even if she wasn't physically injured, so long as she was touched by the defendant's negligence, she could recover. In Amaya, they say, no, you don't actually have to touch this person, but they have to be in physical peril. Because the mother could observe this from a position of physical safety, she wasn't in that zone of danger and didn't qualify. When the mother brings the appeal, the mother says, what kind of nonsense is that? How can you say that my daughter was injured in this case and deserves a recovery, but I do not? This is nonsense. What's the defendant's answer as to why it's not nonsense? What's the defendant's justification for continuing to observe the rule that requires the plaintiff to be in the zone of danger? What's that? Well, that's the rule, but why? Why do we have that, Mr. Cleveland? Okay. And this is where I think I mentioned the... Yes, but earlier my summary of the court's response to that argument is duty schmooty. That is, well, what's this duty concept you're throwing around? And this phrase that I find kind of memorable here on page... this is on page 88. Right-hand column, first full paragraph. Again, sort of, this is the court's more formal. This paragraph might have the heading, Duty Schmooty. Okay? The assertion that liability must nevertheless be denied because defendant bears no duty to plaintiff, now quoting Prosser, St. Prosser, begs the essential question whether the plaintiff's interests are entitled to legal protection against the defendant's conduct. Duty is a shorthand statement of a conclusion rather than an aid to analysis in itself. It should be recognized that duty is not sacrosanct in itself, but only an expression of the sum total of those considerations of policy which lead the law to say that the particular plaintiff is entitled to protection. Now, what's significant about this is that the court is giving you a pretty big dose of legal philosophy here. It is basically refusing to adopt Cardozo's view that we ask the duty question first and see where that leads. This court is essentially saying you're looking through the wrong end of the telescope. To conclude whether there is a legal duty, we have to first ask the question, what outcome do we think is appropriate? Should the plaintiff recover in this case? If we decide through the sum total of policy considerations that lead us to conclude the plaintiff is entitled to protection from this kind of harm, then we say a legal duty is owed. If you, Cardozo, think you can start with duty and then use it to rule people in and out, you got it all backwards. Now, I think it's worth thinking about this for a moment. If the court is correct then in effect, the law is simply, again, the sum total of, well, we think it's fair for this defendant to pay that plaintiff, but we don't think it's fair for this defendant to pay this plaintiff over here. We kind of categorize and sort these things out and then come up with some sort of general descriptive rule, but we don't pretend to have any sort of larger principle upon which this is based. Whereas Cardozo seems to have the idea in his head that there is something, it is not an arbitrary decision as to whether or not a duty is owed. The question is, could it be reasonably foreseen? Was Cardozo's point, and only when it could be reasonably foreseen, then you have a right to hold the defendant accountable for it. Now, the court, interestingly, does go back to the principle of foreseeability as sort of the touchstone for whether or not somebody should be held liable. Do they think it's foreseeable that the mother would suffer injury if the defendant negligently drove his car? Yes, they do. They're not inviting the jury to simply rule these people in and out on the basis of foreseeability. The court provides three factors to consider, and on the basis of these factors, we can then decide whether something is foreseeable or not. What are the factors the court wants us to... Ms. Roberts? I'll just put not. And you can imagine, and this is part of... the other reason Dillon versus Legg is sort of this spring of continuing discussion. You can play with the facts of Dillon versus Legg to shade from one situation to another, you know, as though you had this gradient from absolute stark white to absolute stark black, and in between you have all these shades of gray. So, the most striking case would be where she has a physical impact. Well, then we say, well, she's not physically impacted, but she's in the zone of danger. Then we say, well, she's not in the zone of danger, but she's close by. Then you say, well, in addition to the mom standing on the porch watching it, Dad was in the backyard mowing the lawn, and even above the whine of the lawnmower engine, he can hear the screech of brakes and a terrible thud, and he stops the lawnmower and comes running from the back porch or from the backyard to the front and sees his daughter's lifeless body on the pavement. Okay, now he's not in the backyard, he's down the street. He gets a cell phone call. 5 minutes later, he gets there while they're putting the daughter's body into the ambulance. No, he's not. Now we move, to where he meets them at the hospital. Now he gets, we keep moving the action a little further away each time, and at what point in this progression do you say we're no longer at the scene? What do we mean by at the scene? And the Washington cases take this very issue up in Hagel versus McMahon. Okay, second factor. Yes, or again, using the example of the dad, suppose the dad, hears the screech of the brakes, let's suppose the mother is talking to her friend on the porch. She doesn't actually see the collision. She hears the noise, turns her head to see, you know, the daughter's body flying through the air, or sees it, you know, in, you know, the few little movements before she loses all activity. The difference between the shock of seeing something traumatic happen versus the fact of losing your child, or losing your sister for that matter. How much of this is direct emotional shock, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, from participating in something where you keep rerunning it in your head over and over again? You keep seeing this thing happen. You can't, I think the psychologists call it these intrusive memories. Someone who's been the victim of violent crime, or someone who's been through some other terrible situation, they keep having this come back to them, and they're trying to concentrate on something, and these memories keep intruding. Okay. Third, as opposed to the fact that I love my daughter, she's gone, and I'm grieving over that. We're not supposed to think about the second part about grieving over the daughter. It is the direct emotional shock from seeing. What's the third factor? Yeah, and I'm I'll change this to put close relationship. Again, these are all in the plaintiff's favor. The closer we have 1, 2, and 3, the stronger the case for saying this is something the defendant ought to have to pay for. Again, what do we consider a close relationship? Are we going to do the same thing we would do in a wrongful death statute to say, well, you know, a spouse, children, parents, brothers, sisters? What about the woman who's, I actually sat on a plane coming back from Seattle the last time. The woman I happened to be sitting next to was flying home from New York to see her mom. She'd gone to Rogers High School. I asked her what she did. She said, I'm a nanny. And, of course, I said, well, have you read the book? She said, oh, yes, of course. There's a very interesting book about, written by these nannies. It's kind of catty, very catty, as a matter of fact. Anyway, so, you know, she has been raising this now three-year-old. She's, in effect, you know, she's there 8 hours a day because the family for whom she is a nanny, the mom is an OBGYN, and they're actually, you know, I'm not going to go into that. This is all I learned. It's fascinating on a plane coming home from Seattle. So, okay, so would she have a claim? Suppose she's at the scene of the accident. This is a child she is bonded with. The child has called her, you know, Nana, learned the words Nana before she ever learned the words Dada or Mama. Does she get a recovery? Not related by blood or anything else. But is that a close enough relationship? Okay, so again, each of these factors has a fair amount of, you know, play in the joints here, but you can state the strongest case. There is no stronger case than the mother watching her child be killed before her eyes. I don't think there is any worse trauma. But as you begin to move away from that, how far can you move away and still qualify? Turberholt. Yeah. Oh, yeah. See, the right. And the difference, for better or for worse, very good point to make here. I think I referred to it at the time we talked about Johnson versus State of New York, the difference between what I would call direct cases and derivative, or in the more colorful way, parasitic cases. This is a derivative or parasitic case. There would be no injury to the mother if it were not for the very severe injury to her family member. Whereas in Johnson versus State of New York, the only injury is directly to the plaintiff. In those cases, we employ this test of saying physical injury or guarantee of genuineness. In the bystander cases, we employ a test like Dillon versus Legg, which says, if you're claiming an injury because of something that happened to your loved one, you've got to meet a test like this. And different jurisdictions use different variations and tweak and modify and may have a different way of approaching it, but all of them have some method of saying which of these cases they're going to allow and which of these cases they won't. Again, the reason why Dillon versus Legg keeps being recycled is because the problem identified in Dillon versus Legg is the perennial one. That is, it's a boundary drawing issue, and it does go back to sort of shades of Paul's graph, where you have, in this case, you have a victim, and then sort of concentric circles of related parties. You know, so you got the sister who's there on the crosswalk, you got the mother on the porch, you've got dad at the office, you've got the other kids from the third grade, you've got the second cousin once removed that you saw once in Cleveland. How far out from this, you know, initial injury are we going to go in terms of saying you get to line up at the cashier's window and ask for your cut, you get to line up and ask for your cut, where do we draw the line? Say, no, sit down. You don't qualify. We're not saying you weren't injured. The following day at school when, you know, the teacher of the third grade class or whatever it is say, I have some terrible news. Some of you may have already heard that, you know, little whatever her name is was killed yesterday in a crosswalk, and, you know, gee, the little kids in the third grade who played with whatever her name was, I'd like to have a name for her, but, you know, Susie or whatever her name is, they're going to be hurt, and, you know, they're going to run home, and we have counselors, you know, if you feel like you need to talk to somebody about it, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not going to let those people recover tort compensation from the defendant. In that sense, it is like Spade versus Lynn, except, I mean, we draw the line, we say the tort system can't handle all of the different people. We're not saying your injury isn't real, we're just saying the tort system can only handle so much. Now, what's significant about the other reason that I like to use Dillon versus Legg is because Dillon versus Legg is the first of a progression. You can see that the next case is Rodriguez, and the case after, well, we have Hagel versus McMahon, actually, that comes first, because that's the Washington equivalent of it. But then afterwards, we get Rodriguez and Borah versus American Airlines. Two subsequent cases from the California Supreme Court with related kinds of issues. Except the fact patterns keep changing, the circumstances keep changing, but plaintiffs still show up at the cashier's window saying, I want my cut, and the court has to decide, okay, you qualify, but you don't. Let's see here. Yeah. On page 91, Note number three, and I'm just going to make a few more comments here before we quit for the day, but in Ballinger versus Palm Springs aerial tramway, there's somebody riding on this aerial tramway when she's the passenger next to her is like on a ski lift kind of a deal. This passenger next to her gets gored by some piece of equipment and dies. The passenger says, I want a recovery for this. I was traumatized. The person next to me died while I was there helpless, you know. Were you physically hurt? No. I was traumatized. Now, according to these criteria, should she be able to recover? Well, I spent, you know, this woman's last hour on earth together. By the time that hour was up, I felt pretty close to her. No? The court said close enough. These are criteria, said the court. They're not elements of a claim. We apply them flexibly. Oh, okay. Now, again, the tension that you have here is if you were a legislator trying to write a statute to specify what it is you want as by way of a rule, or if you're a member of a Supreme Court trying to lay down principles to guide trial courts in the future, you have two choices, or at least you have two things you'd like to accomplish, but they're in conflict with each other. One is to provide relatively clear guidance, nice, clear, bright lines. The other is to avoid arbitrary distinctions. And sort of like writing a tax code, the things are in conflict. When you try to sort of equalize things and make like situations be treated similarly, instead of saying, well, we have an arbitrary rule, mothers get to recover, but babysitters don't, what happens if the babysitter has a closer relationship than the mother? You're saying the mother who, you know, left the family and has been gone for 6 months at a time, in and out of drug rehab, you know, et cetera, whereas the babysitter who's getting close to adopting this kid, but then the baby gets killed, you mean the babysitter gets nothing and the mother whose relationship with, just because, okay, we want to have a more flexible rule that says a close relationship. But if you go down that road, where everything's kind of flexible, you provide no guidance for the trial judge who's stuck trying to read 100 different cases, each of which has a slightly different shake of the kaleidoscope here, and you get lost. So, as we'll see, the courts wind up sometimes bending the rules because they want to be more flexible and take account of the unique circumstances, and other times you'll see them draw a sharp, bright line saying, maybe it's arbitrary, but we got to do some things to keep this system from spinning out of control. And I would say nobody's particularly happy with any of this stuff. There isn't a nice, clean solution to it. It's all kind of a compromise between how much you want a clean, bright line and how much you're willing to simply float with whatever looks good to the trial judge. Anyway, we'll pick up at that point tomorrow. I'm just find my cursor here.